Welcome to Planet Geo, the podcast where we talk about our amazing planet, how it works, and why it matters to you. Christopher, what's up, man?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Recording with my buddy Chris. How could we be bad?
Your little buddy.
My little buddy, yes. Chris. What's up, man? Oh, man.
Not a whole lot. It's good. All's good.
Yeah. Well, this is a good one because this is a wrap, basically, on our plate tectonics question list, which you got very worked up about in, what was it, September or something like that, I guess. This was a long time ago that we started this whole process, maybe later than September.
September, October. Yeah, it was right away, but the beginning of this school year.
So this is, I mean, we'll probably come back to this with part 8 in, you know, next year or something like that. But this is part 7.
8 through 10.
Through 10 or 15, however many we get to. But this is a big topic. And this is a big episode too, I think. This is a really important episode. So we kind of have to cover it, and we want to end on it.
Well, let's say what this is. This is about rocks and climate. Can we determine what Earth's ancient climate was when we look at ancient rocks? That's really what this is all about today. And
let me add one thing to that, Chris, because I think we're going to kind of come from this. I think we sort of have to come from this from two sides. Like, how do rocks interact with climate? Like, we should at least touch on that briefly, how rocks interact with climate, which sets the stage for how can we use old rocks to understand climate as well. Like, those are kind of two sides of the same coin, this rock climate interaction.
This was kind of my idea, this episode, but it came from one of my students, actually, in astronomy class.
That's great.
Yeah, she was doing a presentation, like a 15-minute presentation that I have all the kids do. They get to pick the topic that they want that is astronomy related, right? And she chose this one, and I was amazed by it. I'd actually never thought about this in this way, about how rocks are affected by the atmospheric composition. And so this episode is tied to plate tectonics, you know, how the atmospheric composition affects the rocks, but then there's parts of it that are not directly tied to plate tectonics. This is a perfect way to end this series.
Yeah, I agree completely. And so I think, Chris, maybe the best way to start out here is to just kind of level set from how this happens today. How do rocks interact with atmosphere today? And sort of a little brief thing about how that affects climate, or really how it is the thermostat of Earth, which is a term that's been used before. But we talked about this going back to one of our really early episodes on hard water and the carbon cycle, the long-term carbon cycle, basically. And so I think, should we start there? Should we just kind of give 5 minutes of background here?
Sure. I'm not sure exactly what direction you want to go. So go ahead, just throw something my way.
So I guess what I'm thinking of is, let's talk about CO2, because we're going to really talk about CO2 and oxygen and how they interact with rocks. So can we just give the intro level, Camp Geo level style of how do rocks interact with CO2, or how do rocks impact the atmospheric CO2 content?
Well, that's a huge topic, Jesse. Oh my gosh. Really?
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, we have to do this. We have to spend a couple of episodes and talk about this carbon cycle, the fast carbon cycle, the slow carbon cycle. But the bottom line is that, you know, carbonates and carbon dioxide is drawn out of rocks through weathering. And it's brought then to the oceans. And then, I don't know, Jesse, if we want to get, do you want to get into the geochemistry? Or that was actually a really dumb question here that I asked the geochemist, if you want to talk about geochemistry.
But obviously, I mean, it's the best. But no, I don't need to go into too much detail here. I think you've covered it. Basically, like, you know, that CO2 is pulled out of the atmosphere by weathering. I think weathering is the key thing here. That is exactly what we're looking for.
Okay, hold on though, Jesse, because you said something that I want to ask you about, and I do want you to explain it, because I think you skipped a couple steps. You just went from one to the other, right? You said that carbon dioxide is drawn out of the atmosphere by weathering. Okay, but I think you need to walk us through that step, or the steps that are in between there.
Sure. And this is a really big and important topic, which you're exactly right. We should dedicate many episodes to, and we should interview some people who maybe are part of these startup companies who are trying to do this as a carbon sequestration mechanism. But basically what happens if you take ultramafic rocks, which we've talked about before, this is the interior of the earth. This is pretty tight, high in magnesium and iron and calcium. Those things, those types of rocks break down easily at the surface, meaning they're weathered chemically and physically very easily. They're not happy at the surface. So when they are at low pressure, low temperature, they're unhappy minerals, they break down. What happens then is calcium, very importantly, also magnesium and iron to some degree, are, the term is solubilized, but basically they're picked up in water and they're carried into the ocean. And when they're carried into the ocean, what they do is they bond with an acid, a CO2-bearing acid. Usually it's HCO3 or one of these acid types, but CO2 goes into the ocean and is a little acid in the ocean, and they bond. Calcium plus this CO3 bond together to form calcite, the mineral calcite in that instance, or dolomite, or any of these organisms can do this. It's biologically mediated today, but basically, so the minerals break down, these ultramafic minerals, we put them on the surface, they basically, through weathering, the ions are transported, they interact with CO2 gas, they interact with CO2 that's been dissolved in water, and they form minerals, and then they're locked up for millions and millions of years in those very stable minerals, like calcite or aragonite or dolomite.
And not to nitpick at all with you, but how is this carbon dioxide drawn out of the atmosphere through this process?
Yeah, so that's sort of a partitioning. That's something that is basically, they're in equilibrium. The atmospheric CO2 and the oceanic CO2 are going to be in equilibrium. So if we take more bicarbonate ions out of the ocean will start to suck up CO2 out of the atmosphere. So they kind of maintain this chemical equilibrium at the surface of the ocean. So that's how this happens. But I would have tie this off at plate tectonics. Let's bring it back to plate tectonics a little bit, because this is a big cycle. There's actually a paper published by some colleagues of mine at Penn State University recently, just this year, that got a lot of press, actually. And the title here is How Temperature-Dependent Silicate Weathering Acts as Earth's Geological Thermostat. I mean, it's a cool title, Geological Thermostat. Yeah. It's a good one. But basically that CO2, it does not go down all the way into the mantle and stay there forever. Those carbonate minerals, those come back up in volcanoes. But that cycle takes millions and millions of years. So this is, you said it earlier, Earth's long-term carbon cycle.
Okay, Jesse, bringing this back to plate tectonics. Okay, let's just simplify this, because I think you went into the weeds a little bit. I'm going to bring it back a little bit. Is basically plate tectonics is the force that lifts things up, right? And so as that happens, that accelerates the weathering and erosion process, which accelerates the removal of carbon dioxide. And exactly. So that's kind of how these gases, atmospheric gases, are tied to plate tectonics. The rate of removal, the rate at which things happen, is tied to elevation.
That's exactly right, Chris. And I just want to double click on that, because you're exactly right. The faster things go up, the more CO2 is going to be drawn back down. Also, what happens is the hotter things get, the more CO2 gets drawn back down, because hotter temperatures, faster reactions, faster chemical weathering, this reactions that are drawing down CO2 happens faster. So over really long timescales, this thing kind of goes up and down and is modulated like a thermostat, where, you know, it goes up and then turns off and then goes down and then turns on. And this is how this works over really long timescales. That, I think, brings us nicely into the discussion of the early Earth and comparisons with a planet like Venus, which Marty Gilmore, who is amazing, and we were lucky enough to interview a while back, she called it Earth's toxic twin, which kind of brings us back home to this paper that I think you wanted to center this discussion around a little bit, about ancient rocks and climate.
That's right. Talking about our neighbors, Mars and Venus, Earth is peculiar.
Definitely.
Mars and Venus, their atmospheres, although very different, right? Venus has an extremely thick atmosphere. Everything about Venus, it has to do with the atmosphere. I mean, it's such a harsh, harsh place because of this. But Mars has a very thin atmosphere comparatively. But they have very similar atmospheric compositions. They are dominated, both of them, by carbon dioxide, and then the second most abundant gas being nitrogen, on the order of 2-3% nitrogen. So 96-97% CO2, and then nitrogen. Okay. Earth is very peculiar in this because we're dominated by nitrogen. It's like 78% of our atmospheric composition. Then oxygen comes in at 21%. And then we have, although very important, our carbon dioxide concentration. We're talking about things on the order of like 415 to 420 parts per million. You know, it's a hugely important gas, but a very small constituent of our atmosphere. So Earth is really, really peculiar in this situation. But we don't think it was always that way. And that's what comes back to plate tectonics and in this whole paper.
Yeah. And we've talked about this a little bit before. We talked about this in, I think, part 4 of this plate tectonics series, which is when did plate tectonics start on Earth? We talked about this in part 3 of this with planetary tectonics. What is the tectonic regime of other planets? And this is part of the big question about the early Earth is what type of tectonics was going on the early Earth? Was it plate tectonics? Was it different? Earth and Venus and Mars are extremely different right now, both in plate tectonics and in atmospheric composition. The question is, were they always different? There's pretty good evidence that Mars had water. We don't really know what Venus had going on in the atmosphere over the last 4.5 billion years. So it's a really interesting problem and deeply tied to plate tectonics, because as we just started out talking about, plate tectonics influences climate and influences the atmospheric composition of a planet.
Okay, so let's start talking then about what we think our early atmosphere was like. Yeah. Can we do that now?
Yep,
all right, so
sure.
First of all, we think that we probably had two atmospheres in ancient Earth. One was when Earth began, you know, when it formed 4.54 billion years ago. Our atmosphere, whatever it was at that time, it went away because we got smacked by a Mars-size object, Theia, that process formed our moon. And that violent collision would have also degassed Earth. I mean, our atmosphere would have been blown into space at that point. So whatever our earliest composition was, that went away. But then it started over again because of this process, right? I mean, you know, when that event happened, Earth was entirely resurfaced. It was molten again. And then that ocean of magma was degassing and creating a new atmosphere. And that's really what this is about today, is what do we think that atmosphere was like? And how can the rocks tell us about that?
I just want to paint a little bit of a visual here, Chris, because I want to get across the point of how violent these things are. I mean, the planet is melted. And in order for the planet to be molten for any period of time, for the top of the planet to be molten at any period of time, we have to have like a thick atmosphere. You can't just be exposed to outer space because the thing will solidify. If the temperature at the surface of this magma pond is space temperature, it's going to cool down and crystallize really, really quickly. But if you have an atmosphere on top of that, you can kind of insulate this, much like Earth is insulated, and it can stay warm for longer. But this is like an atmospheric composition that right after this impact, you have silica in the atmosphere. So you have like, basically, this is a rock dust atmosphere. It's like a volcanic eruption. You know, it's just full of particles and gas. It's so hot that stuff that should not be gas is gas. And it's an extreme atmospheric composition in that first stage that you're talking about.
Okay, let's talk about this then. Like, what kind of research is being done? You know, the papers are saying that we think our early atmosphere was similar to what Venus and Mars have today in terms of like overall percentages. In other words, we were dominated by carbon dioxide, then probably nitrogen. Okay, what's being done? How in the world can ancient rocks tell us about the chemistry of our atmosphere?
Yeah.
Let's go in that direction. I think this is like, I mean, you live in this world a whole lot more than you do. So what's going on? Because I think this is just fascinating. This is so cool.
So, okay, there's a whole bunch of different ways to do this. And I think this is actually a really nice leading one, because we're going to have an episode coming up in the next month or so here on banded iron formations. And banded iron formations are a sedimentary rock type that don't exist on the modern Earth, or don't form on the modern Earth, but they formed a lot back in early Earth. And that tells us that Earth's atmosphere was different. So we know for sure Earth's atmosphere was different. For instance, there was no oxygen or barely any oxygen in Earth's atmosphere prior to 2.5 billion years ago. We can use sedimentary rocks that kind of record this interaction they record the climate conditions a little bit, or they record certain aspects of the climate conditions. We can also look in minerals that are formed with fluid around. So things like quartz inclusions. Sometimes quartz has little gas bubbles in it, and quartz can form near the atmosphere and it can crystallize, and there might be some atmospheric gas around. And so there's really old quartz crystals that people argue have a sort of a record of the early atmosphere, or at least something close to the early atmosphere.
That's really interesting. Can I interrupt you a second?
Yeah.
Don't lose your train of thought, but okay. That does bring up a point too, that we're talking about going back billions of years and looking at atmospheric composition. We're able to go back maybe hundreds of thousands of years by looking at little bubbles that are trapped in ice cores. Okay. You know, we have the Greenland ice sheet, we have the Antarctic ice sheets, and these are basically time machines for us. You know, the deeper that we drill down into the ice and we are able to analyze these little bubbles of tens of thousands of year old atmosphere. So we can do that. That's not what we're talking about today. We have to go back much further in time, and we have to look at rocks then.
And we have to also look at not really the atmosphere. Like when a quartz crystal grows, it's usually growing, it's not growing right at the surface like ice does. You know, it's not actually grabbing a piece of the atmosphere. It's maybe some gas that's in chemical communication with the atmosphere, but is modified, maybe a couple hundred meters down in the earth. Like the gas is different than the atmosphere. So it's not a perfect sample of atmospheric gas, but it is, you know, we can make a relationship. There's a relationship between the composition of this little bubble in quartz and the actual atmospheric composition. But those samples are few and far between. The other thing that we can do is look at rocks, as we've talked about here, and as the sort of we're centering this conversation on. And people have looked at rocks, and basically what this comes down to is looking at the chemical composition, usually of iron, sometimes of other elements. For instance, zircon has some chemistry in it that can get at the broadly the composition of the atmosphere, but it's not perfect, but usually of iron. And the key here is that rock composition has a little bit to do with the atmosphere. Certain rocks have a little bit to do with the atmosphere. And so let me just ask you a question here, Chris. If I was to go through, pressure's on. Yeah, perk up, exactly. Yeah, straighten up, here we go. So if I was to say, I want you, Chris, to go find me a rock type that has a record of an interaction with the atmosphere, what broad general category of rock would you be most likely to select? And I'm thinking, intro level physical geology categories here.
All right. So I'm going to look for something that's mafic or ultramafic, because I'm going to be looking for something that is loaded with iron. You just got done talking about the importance of iron. Basically, we're looking. Did I get that right, by the way?
Yeah. I want to go one
ramble on.
I want to go one level deeper, though.
Or do you want the name of the rock?
Well, okay. I'm thinking, where is this rock found? What would this rock have experienced? I mean, are you looking for a gabbro? Are you looking for, mafic intermediate composition? But can you?
I'm looking for a rock that was extrusive at the time that it formed.
Perfect. That's
right. Because we want to have something. Oh, I feel so good. Like the pressure's off me now. we want to have something that was directly interacting with our atmosphere. Right. And so what we're basically talking about is what happens to iron. Everybody knows this. Iron rusts. Okay. And this is, if we were talking about this in a chemistry context, that's the oxidation of iron. But there are various different oxidation states that can happen. And by looking at the oxidation state of iron, then we can determine what the composition of the atmosphere was that was interacting with that rock at the time that it formed.
Right. I think a good way to sort of set this stage, and so what we're talking about here is how much oxygen is in the atmosphere. So think of it this way. You have iron, and iron is hanging onto electrons on the outer shell, and oxygen really loves to grab electrons. Oxygen super loves electrons. And so oxygen is going to strip away electrons and make iron lose electrons. And iron can lose two electrons. That's iron 2+. So it becomes 2+ because it lost two electrons. Or iron can become 3+ and it lost three electrons. And when it becomes 3+, that's the oxidation, quote unquote, oxidation state of iron. that means that there's more oxygen around because more oxygen is grabbing more electrons, basically. I mean, in a really rudimentary sense, that's what it means. But I think it's important, Chris.
Can I just interrupt you a second? So what that would form then with an abundance of oxygen is it's going to form Fe2O3. As opposed to when you have less oxygen, it'll form a 1-to-1 ratio because it only lost 2 electrons. It'll form FeO.
So you're exactly right, but I think people might get lost in the numbers there. Can you balance those equations? Because I just said Fe3+ gets formed with more oxygen, and then you said Fe2O3. Okay. So why the numbers here? Can you just explain that?
I think so. So when ions combine, when they come together, the electrical nature of matter, opposites attract. So the iron, which is Fe3+ in this situation, is going to bond with oxygen in the negative state, but they have to come together to form a neutral charge. So if I have two irons, Fe2, that gives me a total +6 charge, right? I need three oxygens. Each of those are -2. And then I have a -6, and I can put them together then in that ratio. So it's Fe2O3 that forms a neutral compound. But in order to do that, you have to have an abundance of oxygen.
So I think if we just back up really quickly here, because if we take iron 3+, so we've got a lot of iron 3+, which, as you said, two of those plus three oxygen, two minuses, makes an even thing. If you have some iron 2+ around, you can't just stuff that in the same mineral because you're going to have too many oxygen. So you have to make a different combination, a different recipe to get a neutral bond here. So the type of iron in a rock will tell us something about the quote-unquote oxidation state, the amount of oxygen around when that rock formed. That's really what we're talking about here, right, Chris?
Absolutely. We're looking at whether or not we have FeO, which means there was less oxygen in the atmosphere that was interacting with the rocks, or whether we have Fe2O3, which means there was more oxygen. So let's just cut to the chase. What do we find with these ancient rocks? What kind of oxidation state are we finding?
Well, we're finding pretty low oxidation state in most of the ancient rocks because, again, we've talked about the fact that there's less free oxygen, less O2 in the early atmosphere than there is today. So by today's standards, fairly low. But that's not necessarily totally low, I guess. Right?
All right. So, Jesse, before we get into some of the other details, I do want to ask something that hopefully you can clear up. We're talking about the oxidation state of iron. So what kind of oxygen are we referring to? Is this just free oxygen in the atmosphere, or can this be oxygen that's tied to carbon in the form of, let's say, carbon dioxide or a carbonate?
Something like that? It's a really good point, Chris, because free oxygen is what everybody thinks about when we're having this discussion about oxygen grabbing electrons from iron. But it's not just free oxygen, O2, that we're talking about, because a lot of the molecules we have in our atmosphere have oxygen in them, H2O, CO, CO2, they all have oxygen in there. And so those things have higher what are called oxidation states, meaning there is more oxygen around, there's more potential for oxygen to grab some electrons from iron. So oxygen fugacity, or FO2 is the term we use, oxygen fugacity, quote unquote, or oxidation state, that's a really complicated thing that depends on the certain combination of gases you have in your atmosphere. Like what the oxidation state, quote unquote, of the atmosphere is, can depend on a lot of different stuff. CO2, CO, H2O, H2, CH4, N2, all that stuff goes in and you make a big recipe.
It can come from all the oxygen that's available, right?
Exactly.
That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's talk about then this experiment, because in order for them to make conclusions about what our early atmosphere was like, we have to be able to do this in lab, right? I mean, and so you said earlier there are a lot of different ways that this can be done, but let's talk about what was done with the paper that we kind of read as a primer to get us ready thinking about this episode. So bottom line is, I'm going to try to paint a picture of what this was like, and I'm really simplifying this a lot, but basically in the lab, they used the laser and they melted the rock peridotite. Okay. And peridotite is ultramafic, which just means this is a rock that is loaded with iron, a lot of magnesium too, but we're talking about the oxidation state of iron. So, and then they used a variety of gases, different compositions, different ratios of the gases that are meant to kind of simulate what our early atmosphere was like. Okay. And this is the part that I found interesting and weird, and maybe I don't know what to think of it, but they were actually able to levitate this melt, you know, in the gas. In other words, they melted the rock and it was levitated inside this chamber. So the gas was available all around the melt, not just the surface of it. It was actually all around. Is that a problem with this experiment? Why is that necessary? Is it just so they can do it faster, you think?
I think it's partially to do it faster. And also, I think... I mean, I'm not an experimental person, so I don't exactly know how these experiments are done or what the limitations of other types of experiments are. But with this thing, you can quench this thing super quick. So it's basically, think of a little tiny bead of prototype that's being melted and levitated up in space, and then there's atmosphere kind of swirling around it. You can cool that down instantaneously. And that's really valuable, because while you cool bigger experiment, think of like a little glass vial full of liquid magma, that takes longer to cool down. And when stuff cools down, it changes the composition. And what we're after is the composition of magma and atmosphere in equilibrium when it is magma at super high temperatures, not what happens after it cools down with all those back reactions that might happen and perturb that in the experiments.
And so what they did is the variable in the experiment was the composition of the gas. They kept changing the composition until the rocks oxidized in the way that we see ancient rocks today.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a really sort of, you know, we're coming at this from the experimental way, because as we've talked about, there's not many rocks preserved from early in Earth history. And most of the rocks that are preserved are completely altered. So if we went back and found a 3.8 billion year old basalt, which do exist, there are basalts that old, very few of them, but those things have been altered so much that any gas, little bubbles that were entrapped, think vesicles or think anything that could be gas in that rock when it formed 3.8 billion years ago, that's all been overprinted by later metamorphism. So we rely on this sort of experimental approach to say, what is possible on the early Earth? And then compare the oxidation state, which is hard to perturb, compare the oxidation state of iron to what we see on Earth. So
bottom line is, what they found to get to replicate the oxidation state in lab with what we find in ancient rocks, our atmosphere was similar then to what it is on Venus and Mars today. In other words, we're talking about upwards of 97% carbon dioxide, about 3% or a little bit less N2 or nitrogen gave us the proper oxidation state in the lab. And so that's the same basically as what we have on Mars and Venus today. So this brings us full circle then back to plate tectonics. So if this was Earth's early atmosphere, where did all the CO2 go? You know, we're obviously very, very different then. And that comes back to a massive part of carbon dioxide removal is tied to plate tectonics, right?
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. So over time, we've removed carbon dioxide because of our oceans and because of plate tectonics.
Yeah. And it's a really important question of where is this stuff all tied up in? Where does it exist? We know there's diamonds down in the mantle. Some of those diamonds have a record of surface carbon down there, probably was CO2 at some point. So, you know, there could be loads of carbon stored in diamonds. There is loads of carbon stored in carbonate rocks. So think any limestone or marble. If you have marble countertops, if you have a limestone out your back door, that's a lot of CO2 stored in that baby right there. And there's not a lot of those rock types on Mars or Venus necessarily that we know of. We might find some later, which gives us a record of ancient Mars or Venus, what that might look like. But I don't know, Chris, it kind of highlights for me the most interesting data point we could ever get from our solar system would be a rock from Venus, because we could do these same sort of calibrations, these same experimental tests on a rock from Venus. If we had a sample from Venus in a lab here at home on Earth, we'd be able to tell a lot about the history of Venus, which I think is a really important comparison. We'd be able to kind of test this model maybe even.
And that's not going to happen, at least not in the foreseeable future. You know, we're not going to get a rock back from Venus. We're going to go to Venus, go back to our Marty Gilmore interview, which was amazing. And we're going to put a probe on the surface again for the first time in decades. But we're not coming back with it. Not it's just going to give us as much data, right? It's going to give us as much data as we can possibly glean from that little bit of time that it's going to be able to survive on that harsh surface. But yeah, we're not going to get a rock back anytime soon anyway. One other thing, right? Because, you know, we talked about how plate tectonics is tied to carbon dioxide and the carbon cycle, right? But there's another part of that carbon cycle too, and that has to deal with our oceans, okay? And so why is Earth unique that we still have water? I mean, we know Mars had water at one time. It lost its oceans. We really think Venus had oceans as well. It lost them. Why is Earth able to retain for such a long time its oceans?
Great and very important question. About which I don't think there's a huge amount of consensus. Lots of ideas about it, but it might have something to do with the distance from the sun. You know, it's not our oceans, our atmosphere is staying intact, or is it staying in this really Goldilocks habitable zone, quote unquote habitable zone, where it's not getting blown away, it's not getting too thick, it's not burning off because the planet gets too hot. So there's a lot of potential reasons, a magnetic field, you know, lots of potential reasons for that. That could exist, but it's a very important one. Or it could be plate tectonics. You know, water is cycling a lot, and plate tectonics, this is sort of a chicken or the egg argument. Some people would like to think that water makes plate tectonics possible. Some people would like to think that plate tectonics makes our oceans long lived.
And hey, funny thing, it all comes back to plate tectonics, Jess. Like, it just does.
It does.
It makes the world go round, you know?
So fun. Well, I think, Chris, that's a good place to wrap up our plate tectonics series here. This was a fun exercise. As hard as it was to convince me that it was a good thing to do, you were totally right. And this was really fun and a good exercise.
Thanks. I will say this, that we might not be done yet, because we might have office hours coming your way about questions. We've gotten a lot of questions, emails about tectonic related issues. So we might not be totally done with it yet. But in terms of like our series, yeah, that's a wrap for that. But we'll definitely be coming back to tectonics related issues for sure.
Absolutely. And that's a great point, Chris. So if you have questions about anything we've covered in plate tectonics or otherwise, send us an email. We are planetgeocast@gmail.com. You can follow us on all the social media. You can hit us up there with DMs as well. We are at Planet Geocast on all the social medias. Go to our website, planetgeocast.com, and there you can like, follow, subscribe, and support us. And Chris, what else?
And the only thing I would add, Jess, rate us. Give us a rating. That really helps us out a lot, helps the algorithms and searchability, and we like that.
We love it. All right.
Yeah.
Peace.
Cheers.